Let's see. I'm going to want to start do some prayers tonight.
Okay.
Does everybody have a access to a prayer book? Okay. Okay.
So there's some. The ones in the chair though are the white binds.
Yeah.
So
okay.
You can figure that out.
So I'm going to need one. Yeah. I'll take a gold one. Yeah.
Okay.
Excuse me, sir. Okay, good evening, everyone. I think we have a couple announcements.
Welcome, everyone. My name is Linda Saw, and I'm the program assistant for Discovering Buddhism. So if you have any questions or, you know, need some wayfinding, anything like that, I am happy to help. The handouts, if you were here last week, the table to pick up handouts was in here. I have moved it outside the Gompa door because it was a bit of a traffic jam trying to pick those up. Homework for tonight's class will be on the little table just outside the Gompa doors. As you exit tonight, you can grab homework for tonight's class. If you were not here last week and you want last week's homework handout as well as just general information about the Discovering Buddhism course and this specific module, those handouts are available as well from last week, so you can pick those up if you didn't already. And then also we have Christy Bass is going to come up and do a quick announcement as well, so hang on one second.
For the first time in a long time, we have childcare for DB classes now. So tonight was kind of just an informal. We grabbed a few teens to be with the kids, but we plan
just
on
grab
getting
them off the street.
Yeah, we just grabbed them off the street. Yeah. You guys look like you're lollygagging around. We're going to get an actual adult in there who's been background checked and all that kind of stuff, you know. So so look for that next week. If you're interested or you have questions, then you can contact me. Or, you know, if you see Linda, then she can get you in touch with me. So.
Okay. Thank you, Christy.
And in that regard, real quick, my email contact is on that general information handout. It's titled, like, About Discovering Buddhism, Module 1. So it's program.db@kadampacenter.org. It's on that handout. So you can shoot me an email or catch me, you know, before or after class. Okay? Thanks.
Okay. Thank you. Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the second class on Mind and Its Potential. This is a 6-week module. Tonight's the second of 6 weeks. Let's see, who is here tonight who wasn't here last week? Okay. We didn't cover a lot of material last week, so I don't think you'll have any problem catching up with us. Now, who was here last week who's not here tonight? How many did I run away? That's what I want to know. Okay. My name's Robbie Watkins, and I'll be leading this class. Tonight is the second class, and we'll really start to talk about what the mind is and how it functions. And I think it's really significant that this is the first course in the 2-year Discovering Buddhism curriculum, because everything we do here at Kadampa Center and in Tibetan Buddhism is so that we can develop our mind, develop its potential for wisdom, a direct understanding of reality, and its potential for compassion, the wish that others be free of suffering. And so we're going to start off with a little meditation tonight. We started that last week, and I hope people were able to set up their meditation space during the week. We're going to begin. Each week I'm going to introduce some of the prayers that we use here at Kadampa Center. You may not be a card-carrying Buddhist, and they may not mean a whole lot to you, but I'd like people just to be familiar with them, because there is a lot of terminology and kind of jargon in these. And if you understand them, they mean a lot more. And it's said that we should always do some prayers before our meditation, before a teaching session, before a discussion session. It's like preparing the soil before we cast the seeds. So the prayers, if we really think about what they mean, they kind of soften the dry, arid soil in our minds, so that the seeds of the Dharma can take root and flourish. So if you have a gold prayer book in front of you, I'd like you to turn to page 34. And if you don't have a gold prayer book, there's some white books in the back of the pockets on the back of the chairs. And let's see, what page is Refuge and Bodhicitta in there?
It's just the first white page.
Okay. Yeah, so either of those. And we're just going to do one prayer tonight, and I'm going to go through it before we say it together, just explaining a little bit about what it means. And the one we're doing is called Taking Refuge and Generating Bodhicitta. And we'll do that in English. And traditionally, this is a prayer that's recited three times at the beginning of teaching sessions or meditation sessions. And it's traditional that we put our hands together at the level of our heart when we say this. You don't have to do that, but I'm just giving you the traditional way we do it. And it says, I go for refuge until I am light. Now, I'm just going to explain this, then we'll read it together. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened. And refuge means turning towards those things that we consider important, that are meaningful for us. So until I become enlightened, enlightenment being that state of perfect wisdom and perfect compassion that is a potential for all of us, for every being with consciousness, enlightenment is a potential. So it says, I go for refuge until I'm enlightened. So it kind of implies once you're enlightened, you don't have to go for refuge anymore. I don't know if that's true or not, but that's very consistent with the Buddha's teachings. He says, you know, he said, Buddhism is just a boat to get you to the other side of the river. In this case, to enlightenment. When you get to the other side of the river, you don't need the boat. So Buddhism per se and all its trappings is not the important thing. It's where you're going that's important. So here we want to go for enlightenment. That's something that we can all aspire to. And until we do that, we go for refuge. And what do we go for? Refuge means a safe place, a place that has meaning for us, a place that we feel at home. So where do we go for refuge if we want to become enlightened? And the Buddha says we go to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. Okay, so we go for refuge to the historical figure of the Buddha, not because he was a god, not because he's going to save us, not because he's going to take all our problems away, but because he was a human being, just like ourselves, who went on this path and did reach enlightenment. So if we want to get to where he wound up, we go for refuge to him. And how does the Buddha help us get to where we want to be? He taught us, and his teachings are the Dharma. Okay, the Dharma refers specifically to the teachings of the Buddha, but the Sanskrit term Dharma in general means that which separates us from suffering. Okay, but in this prayer we're referring to the teachings of the historical Buddha, his description of the path that led him from his state of unhappiness and suffering to enlightenment. And then the Supreme Assembly, which is also lots of times we use the word Sangha there, which refers to, in the technical sense, it refers to the ordained monks and nuns, those who have taken vows and are wearing robes and are keeping the various vows that they've taken. So that's officially the Sangha, but it's also used in the more general sense of all the other people who are on the path. So that gives us a little bit of encouragement that we know that there are other people on the same path from where we are now to enlightenment. So until I'm enlightened, I go to the Buddha, the historical example, his teachings, and the other people who are following that path. By my practice of giving and other perfections, this refers to six qualities of mind, generosity, ethics, joyful effort, patience, understanding of the nature of things, and compassion. These are called the six perfections. So this is getting a little bit more specific. Those are things we practice along the path. We haven't perfected them. They haven't become perfections for us yet, but they're qualities that we aspire and we cultivate in our mind stream. So that's what we're doing on the path. We're practicing giving and the other five perfections. May I become a Buddha. May I become an enlightened being. May I completely develop my qualities of wisdom and compassion. Why? For personal happiness? No, for something much greater than that, so that I can benefit all sentient beings, sentient referring to beings with consciousness, okay? Not just for myself, but all sentient beings, not just my family, not just my friends, but the people I don't like, the people I don't know, all the animals, and if you accept the Buddhist cosmology, all the beings who are in other realms that we are not even aware of. So that's what we talked about last week, the Mahayana aspiration. I want to get to enlightenment so that I can be of benefit to others, or be the benefit of all sentient beings, which includes yourself. Okay, so it's this huge, expansive wish. So that's basically what this first prayer that we say all the time here at Kadampa Center, and if you're in an advanced course, you can learn to say it in Tibetan. But we'll stick with English right now. Okay? Let's read that together three times. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. Okay, so now we'll begin our meditation session. Start by establishing your posture. Just to review it quickly, the back a little bit straighter than you normally sit. Head straight on your shoulders. Eyes either lightly closed or slightly open. Mouth lightly closed, not clenched. Shoulders down and back a little bit so your chest is open. Upper arms away from your torso. And right hand on left with thumbs touching slightly below your navel. If you're sitting in a chair, your feet are flat on the floor or a cushion underneath your feet. If you're sitting on a cushion on the floor, sit a little bit to the front of the cushion so your pelvis opens up a little bit and your legs are in a position that you find comfortable and non-distracting. So just take a moment and scan your body from the top of your head down to the soles of your feet. And if you identify any areas of discomfort or stress, address them now so that they don't bother you during the meditation. And to help calm our mind, we take three deep breaths from the abdomen with the stomach expanding on the in-breath as our diaphragm is pulled down and contracting towards our spine on the out-breath. So three deep breaths like that. And now we allow our breathing to return to its normal pattern. And we begin our meditation by setting our motivation, which we've already done to some degree with our reading the Refuge and Bodhicitta prayer. But let's go back to that last line, that I'm doing this simple little meditation this evening to develop positive qualities in my mind that will be of benefit to all sentient beings, including myself. And having set our motivation, we now begin the actual meditation. Just a simple breathing meditation. Our mind is on the movement of the breath in and out through our nostrils. Just the physical sensation of the air moving in and out. Nothing more than that. We're not thinking about it. We're not picturing it in our mind. We're not describing it to ourselves. Just direct experience. Mind on the breath. Non-dual. No separation between the mind and the object of concentration. And every time we notice that our mind has wandered off to a sound we hear outside, or to an itch on our foot, or the thought of something we need to do on the way home, or the memory of something that happened earlier today, we just set that aside and come back to the breath. Over and over and over again. And that's the meditation. So we'll do that for about 10 minutes. Stretch ourselves a little bit. And we can end our meditation by making a brief dedication. We acknowledge that we've done something positive just by sitting quietly like this. And we think, may that positive imprint not be wasted, but may it ripen in a way that is of benefit to all sentient beings. One thing I forgot to mention when I was discussing the refuge and bodhicitta prayers, the word bodhicitta. That's a Sanskrit word, meaning the mind of enlightenment, and it's what's expressed in the last line of the prayer, the wish to become enlightened for the benefit of all sentient beings. That quality in the mind is called bodhicitta, and the person who has mastered that, who has developed that quality, so it pervades everything that they do, is referred to as a bodhisattva, which is a very highly realized being. It's not, you're not yet a Buddha when you become a bodhisattva, but you're really getting there. So it's kind of interesting. What language did the Buddha teach in? Anybody know?
Pali.
Yeah, okay. And then they were I don't know if anybody here speaks any Pali, but then his teachings were translated into Sanskrit, and that's what most of the teachings are, the sutras are in Sanskrit, and then they were translated into Tibetan when the teachings went to Tibet. But you can see the difference between bodhicitta, which is a Sanskrit word, and then these Tibetan words, which typically tend to be very short, lots of consonants words, sangye choda sogi chonam la, as opposed to bodhicitta. So where you can recognize which ones are Tibetan and which ones are Sanskrit pretty easily. Let's see. Any questions about that prayer or about the meditation we did? Any questions or comments? And if you do want to say something, wait for the mic to come around, because there are hundreds of people listening to us around the world, I think. Or at least one or two, maybe. Brian said, we're up to five? Is that what the count is? Okay. We got five people out there. Any comments or any questions about the prayer or the meditation? Okay. So this class is called Mind and Its Potential. As I said, everything in Buddhism is about developing our mind, and you can come to Kadampa Center sometimes and you'll hear people banging on drums and ringing bells and doing all sorts of mudras with their hand and be incense around. And if it freaks you out, just remember that's to develop our minds. If you keep that attitude towards all the things, all the teachings, and everything that's included in the next 12 modules of Discovering Buddhism, that's going to be a very solid basis to approach the teachings. Think, what kind of effect is this having on my mind? Is this benefiting my mind? Is this useful for my mind? Always bring it back to yourself. The Buddha said, don't accept anything just because I told you. Okay, take it and test it against your own experience. And if it doesn't seem true, or if it doesn't seem valuable, set it aside. There's no need to take everything at once and become a true believer and say, I accept it all. It's perfectly acceptable to take those parts that work for you and work with those and develop your mind, because it's your mind that's the important thing. So always bring everything that you hear here back to your mind and your own experience. It said you should be like an assayer who's testing metal to see what's gold and what's lead and which is valuable and which is not. So we're talking about mind. So we need to figure out what we mean when we're talking about mind. And I'm going to use the words mind and consciousness pretty much interchangeably. Okay. They mean basically the same thing in this philosophical model. I'm not talking about the brain. I'm not actually talking about the thoughts themselves. Okay? We're talking about mind or consciousness. So there's certain qualities or characteristics of the mind that were touched on in the video we watched last week. And if you get nothing else out of this course, if you space out for the next 4 weeks, at least remember these things that we're talking about tonight. Because this is really the core of this module. So there's certain, when we start to talk about mind or consciousness, there's certain characteristics or qualities that we can describe so that we get to a point where we're all talking about the same thing, more or less. The first quality of the mind, in the Tibetan point of view, or of consciousness, is that it is completely non-physical. Okay? It is not the brain. It is not the neurotransmitters. Is not the synapses or anything physical that you can find. It is a completely non-physical phenomena. It is related to the brain. It's related to the neurotransmitters. But it is not the brain, okay? Consciousness or mind is a completely non-physical phenomena. It has no physical characteristics in any way, shape, or form. Okay? So that's the first thing we want to get clear on. We'll talk about this a little bit more. Let's see. Second characteristic, it is without beginning and it is without end. There is no, and we're talking about individual consciousnesses. We're not talking about a group collective consciousness. If we look at our own mind, our own consciousness, according to the Buddha, there is no point at which it began. It did not start when we were born into this lifetime. He said, for every moment of consciousness or every moment of mind, you can find a previous moment of mind. A previous one before that, a previous one before that, a previous one before that. So just in this lifetime, we can trace our consciousness back to where we don't remember anything prior to that, but we know that our mind was there. And the Buddha says, similarly, just because you don't remember consciousness in previous lifetimes, is not proof that it was not there. Because most of us can't remember anything from when we were 6 months old, but we assume that we did have a consciousness at that point. So this is positing previous lifetimes, reincarnations, rebirth, whatever you want to call it, previous episodes of time in which this non-physical consciousness came together temporarily with the physical body. That's lived for a certain amount of time together and then separated, the consciousness continuing forward, the body decaying. And that's what Buddhism describes as the moment of death, when the consciousness and the mind, consciousness and the body separate. Okay? Temporarily come together, separate. The consciousness, we can trace it back countless previous unions with various bodies. Not just human bodies, but according to the Buddha, animals and beings in other realms. And there is no point where that consciousness began. Similarly, the consciousness will continue into the future without end. When we die in this lifetime, the body decays, the consciousness continues through what's known as the bardo or the intermediate state, and then combines with another physical form. That's said to happen when the egg and the sperm come together in the mother's womb. That's when consciousness enters. That body, and our consciousness continue and then separate again. Okay, there is always a previous moment of consciousness, and there will always be a future moment of consciousness. Absolutely no beginning, absolutely no end. Even when we achieve enlightenment, our consciousness continues indefinitely without end. No temporal beginning and no temporal end. That's very different from what most of us think, kind of instinctively. We'll talk some more about what that means. So the consciousness has no beginning. And no end. It's a continuum, a stream, a ever-flowing river, okay? The third characteristic of the consciousness, and they talked about this a little in the film last week, the mind has, what's a good way to say this? It has no, the mind itself, the consciousness, has no fixed qualities, okay? No unchanging characteristics, okay? In this life, we tend to think, I am an angry person. I am a depressed person. I am a generous person. Those are not fixed qualities of the mind. It's said that the mind is like empty space. And everything that we think is arising in that empty space, but the ultimate nature of the mind is said to be empty. Okay, it's a space in which thoughts arise, one after another, continuously, the stream of consciousness, but those are not the qualities of the mind itself. It is lacking in any fixed qualities. Okay, so this is actually quite good news. That's what allows us to become enlightened. The fact if we were stuck with the mind that we have in this lifetime, it would be impossible to get enlightened. But the Buddha says all you have to do is change the quality of the thoughts that arise in the empty space of your mind, and that's how you become enlightened. Okay? Now, if you want to just think angry thoughts over and over again, he says that's fine. But it's not the path to personal happiness or happiness for others. If you want to be happy, you develop the qualities of wisdom and compassion, which are just thoughts arising in the empty space of your mind, of your consciousness. Another image that's given is a perfectly blue sky is the mind, and the clouds that pass through the sky are the various thoughts. They exist. They're in the sky, but they're not changing the ultimate nature of the sky. They are not the sky. Okay, the mind is this vast, empty space in which thoughts arise. And by thoughts, we mean, we're talking about intellectual thoughts, 2 + 2 = 4. Likes and dislikes, I like that color red, I don't like that color green. Emotions, love, hatred. Those are all in the category of what we call thoughts in Buddhism. There's no distinction that we sometimes make in the West between mind and heart, okay? Intellectual thoughts and emotional thoughts. They're all mental phenomena. They're all something that's occurring in our mind. In fact, the Tibetans, when they talk about their mind, they point here. They say this is where the mind is, okay? So, it has no fixed characteristics. Everything we think about ourselves is not permanent. It's just temporary thoughts arising in the mind. No fixed qualities. And I'm going to throw in that word empty because that's a real jargony word in Tibetan Buddhism, but I think that gives us a sense of what we're talking about. Okay? Three characteristics. The mind is non-physical, it's without beginning and without end, and it has no fixed qualities. Okay, and the Buddha, this is what the Buddha said he saw as he sat under the Bodhi tree. and looked at his own mind. And he's saying, if you're honest with yourself and look at your own mind, you'll see these things yourself. But don't accept it just because he said so. Check it out against your own experience. So those are three qualities. And then the last one is a function. What does the mind do? And we could say to think, but basically that's kind of a crude way of saying it. What we say its function is to perceive. Let's see, is it I-E or E-I? I can never remember. E-I before E, except after C. Perceive or be aware. Okay, and that describes what's happening in these thoughts that arise in the mind, okay? I perceive a red cushion here. I'm aware of a red cushion. That's a thought in the mind. Buddha said if we look carefully, we have 64,000 thoughts in the snap of a finger, if we're willing to look at our mind close enough. I mean, it does seem our mind's basically pretty uncontrolled, okay? But then, I think about somebody I like and I have a warm feeling, a feeling of love. That's another thought that's something that I'm perceiving, something that I'm aware of, okay? It's not my mind, but it is a thought, a mental phenomena occurring in that space of the mind. Now, most of us have certain thoughts that come up over and over and over again. The Buddha said we're very much a creature of habit. And Venerable Rabina, one of the teachers you saw in the movie last week and will be coming here this summer, she said, all Buddhism is developing new habits, new mental habits, ones that work better for you. The Buddha said, because our mind has no fixed qualities, we can eliminate everything that makes us unhappy. Not just lessen it, not just learn to cope with it, but he said you can completely eliminate all thoughts of anger from your mind stream so that you never again experience a moment of anger. You can eliminate all jealousy, and you can develop wisdom and compassion so that they are there nonstop in your mind without effort. Because the mind is empty. It has nothing, there's nothing permanent. So the things we don't like, we can remove them. The things we do like, we can cultivate them. So that's really, it's really a very optimistic point of view. Not that we can just get a little calmer or a little bit more peaceful, but we can completely eliminate depression, sadness, all those qualities from our mind stream. Now, it's not easy, and it doesn't happen overnight. But the Buddha is saying it's a possibility for all of us. Okay? So if we like perceiving compassion, love, patience, we have to create the causes for those thoughts to arise. If we don't like being aware of anger, irritation, depression, we have to eliminate the causes for those thoughts. Because all these thoughts arise due to causes. They're not random. What do we call that when we talk about causes in Buddhism? Karma, okay? Yeah. It seems like our mind is completely uncontrolled, but the thoughts that are arising are actually the results of past actions, okay? So if we don't like certain thoughts, we get rid of the causes for them. If we like certain thoughts, we create the causes for them. Okay? Non-physical. No beginning, no end, no fixed qualities, it's empty, okay? And its function is to be aware, or to perceive. Okay, so we got a couple comments or questions. Let's see, do we have a floating mic somewhere? Yeah.
Just a clarification. When you say it perceives, my understanding from what you said is that it interprets. It labels. Is that what you mean?
Or well, I like the phrase to be aware of, okay?
Okay.
To perceive. And, okay, it's very simple when we're talking about, okay, I perceive a cup. You know, that seems pretty straightforward. This physical object
right.
creates a thought of cup in my mind when my eye and my okay. consciousness interact with it. But that actually is not simple. It's very complicated.
Okay.
And this is where we get in some of the future classes. Where is the cup? Is it really out okay. here? Or is it in my mind? Or is it somewhere in between the two, some sort of interaction? And this is where all this complicated Buddhist, the different schools and everything. What is the nature of the interaction between the mind and the object that it perceives, the object it's aware of? So with objects, it's simple. But emotions, memories, thoughts are all also things that our mind is perceiving in the same way that it perceives the cup.
But they arise after the mind is aware of something. So first is the awareness.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Then the emotion or the thought arises.
Yeah. Because, okay. again, it's not so much the subject of this class, but part of the problem, or part of our problems comes from the fact that every time we perceive something or we're aware of it, mm-hmm. then we automatically jump to, I like it, I don't like mm-hmm. it, or I don't care. I mean, and that is, you know, that's 99.9% of what's going on in our mind. If we're willing to look at it. I mean, it's very infantile, actually. You know, something, a color comes up or a taste or something. I like it. I don't like it. I don't care about it. We're already interpreting that way. It's so fast right now. We can't even stop it. Okay. Okay. Let's see. We got some other hands up. Let's.
Could you say a little bit more about how it changes when we're referring to memory?
How changes?
How perception and how that relationship of where, how we dance between those two things. When it's an object, it's easy, but when you're talking about memory, it's different.
Well, but we think it's different, okay? It's not really, okay? The Buddhist point of view is this cup and my memory of a cup I drank out of when I was a child are in the same, they're not really different, okay? One is not more real than the other. They are both what we refer to as phenomena, okay? So this cup that's right here, my mind is perceiving it. My memory of a cup from 20 years ago, my mind is perceiving that also.
But don't we paint that one nostalgically?
Well, that comes in later, yeah, but the fundamental phenomena of cup or memory of a cup are in the same nature, yeah. Okay. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, and then you said something about the mind not having any particular quality. It's empty.
Yes.
What about
its ultimate nature. Its lack of qualities is its ultimate nature, yes.
But where does basic goodness come from? Because isn't there a tenet of Buddhism that says that all sentient beings have basic goodness?
Well, there's a phrase, we talk about Buddha nature, which the way I've been taught, and again, you'll hear different explanations of this, is Buddha nature is our potential to become a Buddha. Okay? Which, if you think about it, is really another way of talking about the emptiness, okay? There's nothing in me that prevents me from becoming a Buddha. I have that potential, but I'm not a Buddha now. Okay? And we all have certain tendencies towards goodness, but we also have certain tendencies towards evil, you know, based on past karma. Okay? So, it's not like we have a little Buddha already inside of us that we just need to clear out all the trash around him. You know, it's a potential. It's something that we all have, in the same way that a cockroach has Buddha nature, has the potential to become enlightened, okay? But whether you can say we're basically good now or not, I don't know if that's what the Buddha taught. Okay? Yeah. Any other questions or comments? Okay. I wanted to mention one other thing when we're talking about the consciousness. There's no eraser here. Anybody have a tissue? Oh, yeah, here. I can use this one. This will work fine. Thank you. It said that we have different levels of consciousness, okay, of this non-physical phenomena. And for simplicity's sake, we divide them up into three, though there are actually many more levels. First, there's the gross consciousness or gross level of consciousness. That's the one that we're experiencing pretty much nonstop, you know, going through, as I say, saying, oh, I don't like that. Oh, it pisses me off that that person turned left in front of me. You know, God, I think that person's really awful. You know, it's this really crude interaction with the world around us. And that's the level of consciousness that we're operating in most of the times. Beneath that, so to speak, there is a subtle level of consciousness. Okay. We experience this when we're dreaming. That's said to be a more subtle level of consciousness. We experience it during sexual orgasm. That's considered to be a more subtle level of consciousness. Said when we faint, when what we refer to as losing consciousness, we're actually experiencing a more subtle level of consciousness then. Okay, it's not dealing in everything as dichotomies, me and the world out there. And then beneath that, this is such a great terminology, there's the very subtle level of consciousness. I'm sure that's the English translation that's used most often. That's the very deep level of consciousness. That's the level of consciousness, the white light consciousness that's referred to sometimes. That is what goes on without end into the future. That's what is without beginning, okay? The gross level is our personality, our who we are in this lifetime. At the moment of death, when the consciousness separates from the body, then the consciousness, it sheds the gross consciousness. That's dropped. That's not carried on into the future. The subtle level of consciousness is dropped, and what continues on is the very subtle consciousness. This is the level of consciousness that carries the karmic imprints into the future and carries the karmic imprints from the past. And it's often referred to as the white light consciousness. And when we die, we will experience the white light, have a direct experience of the white light consciousness. But it's probably going to go by so quickly, they say, in the middle of so much trauma, physical pain, and things like that, that we won't even notice it. But this is why people like His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, these great meditators, he does this meditation 4 to 8 times a day on going through the death process, and that's the subject of another module about what happens when we die. He practices losing the gross consciousness, losing the subtle consciousness, so that at the moment of death, he will be prepared to experience the white consciousness and take advantage of that, okay? Really have some control over the death process. So you practice it over and over and over again so that you'll be prepared for that the moment of death. Okay, but I just wanted to introduce these three terms. We're not going to talk about them a whole lot, but you may hear about them. It's not like our personality goes for into the next lifetime. You know, everybody likes to think they were Napoleon in a previous lifetime or Cleopatra or something like that. That's, You know, all that stuff is shed. We don't carry that forward. That's why most of us don't have any memories of previous lifetimes, because those memories exist in the gross consciousness. That's dropped, and it's this very subtle consciousness that is this continuum without beginning and without end. Okay? Any more questions or comments on anything we've covered tonight? Yeah, okay. Mike in the back there, please.
Okay, so we're all pretty familiar with something called a deja vu.
Mm-hmm.
And where do you see that in relationship to the gross?
Yeah, and, you know, certainly there are examples that seem fairly convincing, particularly of children who remember previous lifetimes, which is not the same thing as deja vu. I can't give an explanation of deja vu, to be honest with you. But some people do carry some of these memories from previous lifetimes through. They're not completely shed. Yeah, I can't give you a good explanation of that from a Buddhist point of view.
Well, so does the gross or the subtle have an influence, if you will, over the very subtle?
They certainly can obscure it, okay? The subtle consciousness perceives things perfectly, okay? The gross and the subtle don't perceive things as they are, so they can distort or cloud the subtle consciousness, or the very subtle. I mean, our very subtle consciousness is there right now. If we could look at our mind closely enough and calmly enough, we'd see it. But we're just so caught up in the gross level of things that we can't even perceive the subtle level, much less the very subtle. But in this lifetime, there are all three going on all the time, okay? We're just not aware of it. We're not tuned into it at all.
Thank you.
Okay, yeah. Any other? Okay, up here.
So I'm still not sure exactly what the subtle level is. Did you say that was a deep sleep state, that we would be in the subtle consciousness when we're in deep sleep?
When we're dreaming.
When we're dreaming.
Dreams. That's the subtle consciousness functioning.
Dreaming. Okay.
Yeah.
And when we get to the level not of enlightenment, but of liberation.
But it's also, you know, the example I gave, you know, sexual orgasm. At the actual moment of orgasm, you know, your gross level of, I've got to stop at the store on the way home and pick up a quart of milk, is not functioning at that moment. It's not a completely non-self experience, but there is something of a loss of personality or something. At the same time, when you faint, okay, you're not thinking, oh, I'm Robbie Watkins and I'm fainting and I'm I need to watch out. You know, it's a somewhat of a non-self experience. Okay.
So when we talk about the idea of achieving liberation, not enlightenment, but liberation.
The freedom from personal suffering.
Would that be a state where we live in that subtle consciousness state all the time and not in the gross personality, egoic identity state?
Mm-hmm. No, you're not. That's a good question. But, you know, the cop-out when you're leading one of these courses is someone asks a hard question like you, you always say, oh, that's a question for a geshe. I would say, but I don't think you would achieve that state of being continually aware of your very subtle consciousness till you achieve complete enlightenment. Okay?
Okay, yeah, I was just asking, like, the subtle consciousness, would that be a liberation state? And maybe the very subtle.
Yeah, I don't know if you can line them up that way or not.
Okay.
I just don't know about that. Yeah. Any other questions? Okay. Yeah. Wait for the mic.
Dr. Watkins, I was reading Happiness, Karma, and Mind from LYWA 1982, His Holiness Dalai Lama in New Delhi. And what caught my attention was he said the mind came into existence because of its own cause. And then somewhat a little bit later, a couple of sentences down, it says, it is not a self-created entity, but is dependent on other factors for its existence. That sounds kind of contradictory, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. I think what he's referring to there when he talks about mind, he's talking about an individual moment of mind. Okay, comes into existence based on a previous moment of mind. Comes into existence based on a previous moment. It just doesn't spring up out of nowhere. Okay, and so that's every moment of consciousness or moment. Again, this gets into terminology. I mean, they start talking about minds and this. I think what he's referring to there is an individual moment of mind. We can always find it comes from a previous moment of mind, from a previous moment of mind, from a previous moment of mind. It doesn't just spring up out of nowhere. Like everything in existence, according to the Buddha, depends upon causes and conditions. Nothing exists independently.
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah. And this is what, you know, Venerable Rabina talked about in the film last week. Our body, our physical being, very much comes from the egg and the sperm. It's the result of the genetic imprints that we get. That comes from our parents, okay? Our mind does not come from our parents, okay? It's a continuum. Every moment comes from a previous moment. You know, it's like a row of dominoes without beginning and without end. Each one's pushing down the next one. And that's what our mind is, just one thought after another coming in sequence. But that does not come from our parents. That consciousness joins with the egg and sperm, the physical aspect of our being, which does come from our parents. But our mind is completely different in how it comes. Now, they're united temporarily, but again, they separate. So she says over and over again, you know, we can't blame our parents for our problems. That's our own karma, yeah. Okay, comment here. Mike, let's see, right in front of you, yeah.
So what about things like mental illness when they have like genetic factors that are like make them more likely? How does that tie
in? Yeah, that would, you know, that falls into the, I think some of that has to do with karma, okay? Having that genetic imprint is a karmic event, is a result of past karma. So every aspect of our body is a result of our past karma. Even though it comes from the egg and the sperm, that egg and that sperm are the results of our karma. There's nothing that's random. So any kind of genetic imprint to have either a mental illness or a physical illness, again, the Buddha's point of view is ultimately it's karma. Now, it may be working through the genes of your parents, but why did you have those parents? Why did you get those genes? Why? The answer is always karma. Why did this happen to me? Yeah. Which is not, again, this is not the class on karma, but it's not blaming you, okay? It doesn't mean you're guilty, okay, or that you're a bad person. It just means that's the inevitable result of things you've done in the past. And we've all, so again, this without beginning, without end, we've all been reborn countless times in every possible situation. We've experienced every illness, every disease, every unpleasant event at some point in the past.
So does Buddhism recognize a soul? It sounds interchangeable with mind.
Yeah, no soul. Okay. What do you mean by soul? What's the definition of soul?
I'm a former Christian.
Yeah. So do we have a current Christian who can tell us? I mean, that's the first thing. What exactly is soul?
Sounds like mind.
Yeah. But I mean, doesn't the soul have certain a basic goodness to it in Christianity? Isn't it that with connects us with God?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So the mind is empty. Okay. It doesn't connect us with anything really. I think the concept of soul is something more permanent or unchanging than what the Buddhism thinks of as mind. Yeah.
I was just curious. So is the mind is created by karma from beginningless time? Is that? Because are my thoughts, they're all from my karma.
Everything in your mind is a result of karma. Yeah.
So
the thoughts you like and the thoughts you don't like, they're all the results of karma. They're not random.
But they've all come from previous moments, and they're
all attached to my very subtle, my karmic imprint.
Yeah, they're riding on it, yeah. So those continue into, yeah, they're not okay. Shed.
Okay.
Just hanging.
You sound a little depressed.
Well, how do you shed them?
Purify, yeah, purify.
Okay, so when I think about basic goodness, I don't think of it in terms of the Catholic or Christian sense.
Mm-hmm.
I think about it in terms of organism, that we have a natural tendency, like a plant will grow towards life.
Mm-hmm.
And we, as a mind, evolve as well, which leads to my next question. So if we're continuously moving and moving through experiences and separating and joining with these bodies, where are we going?
Well, it depends on where you want to go, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we have all this negative karma we're accumulating. We also have positive karma that we're accumulating. You know, the advantage of being reborn this time around as a human being is we can intentionally add to the good karma, which is going to point us towards enlightenment, okay? If we choose, okay? We have more, we're not completely free, but we have more freedom in a human rebirth than in most other rebirths. Now, I've heard it said, and I don't know if this is true or not, this may be, you know, someone who didn't know what there's, that most consciousnesses are, you know, they go up and down, they're gradually moving towards enlightenment. I don't know whether that's true or not. Okay. Yeah.
I don't like the fact that we say everything the child that is born into it is his own karma.
Mm-hmm.
Because as a society, we are equally creating the problem.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people who are born into abuse or into refugee,
mm-hmm.
all these are, we are also equally creating that, no, mm-hmm. don't you think?
Well, the Buddhist point of view, again, and you don't have to like it or accept it, is that if you're born into that kind of environment, that is karma from the past, from other lifetimes.
Mm-hmm.
And we've all been born into those environments countless times. Okay, maybe not this lifetime, but we've all been there and done it in the past. It's not random. That's a very strong effect of our past karma, what kind of environment we're born into. If, you know, maybe a very violent environment, maybe an environment without adequate food or water. That's a result of karma, which is not to say that we're to blame or we're guilty, but that's just the result of actions in the past. You plant a negative seed at some time in the past, you're going to experience those results at some time in the future.
So if we don't do anything to help the people in that situation, then we are going to be born into that.
Yeah. But it can be very, you know, the other bad thing about that is it's very hard to do good actions if, you know, you're just trying to survive. You know, you don't have the luxury of coming and sitting on a meditation cushion every Monday night, you know, if you're in Rwanda or something, yeah. But it's all karma. See, we got one hand back there, and then we're going to meditate a little bit. Okay, they got it.
Okay. Oh. So everybody, all beings eventually reach, they get rid of all their bad karma.
They have that possibility.
So
yeah.
Could it be that at some point all bodies cease to exist, and it's just minds?
At that point, okay.
Everything's Buddha.
Well, you are enlightened. The mind is enlightened, okay. And at that point, if you think it would be beneficial for others, for you to take the body of a cockroach, you say, okay, I'm going to be reborn as a cockroach for the benefit of Robbie Watkins, who hates him and wants to squish me, but maybe he'll learn a little bit of compassion. You know, they say, see everything as a Buddha, you know, as an enlightened being who's there to help you, okay? But it's entirely a matter of choice at that point. For us, it's the result of karma. We don't have any or very little control over it. But a Buddha can choose to be, or a Buddha can just choose to stay off in bliss for, you know, countless eons before he chooses to be reborn, yeah, depending on what's most beneficial. Okay? All right. Let's do another meditation to finish up this evening. Okay, begin by checking your posture. I think you're familiar with it by now. Three deep breaths from the abdomen to help calm our mind, let the chatter subside a little bit. Now take a moment and set your motivation for the meditation that's to follow. And we'll begin this meditation with just a couple minutes of watching the breath, the mind on the breath, nothing more, nothing less than that. Mind being directly aware of the breath with no gap in between the two. Mind aware of breath. So you can almost say that they have the same nature. The movement of the air through our nostrils and the mind perceiving that are identical. Now that our mind is a little bit more concentrated and focused, we're going to meditate for a couple minutes on the ultimate nature of the mind, which is its quality of emptiness or lack of any fixed qualities. That may be a little bit hard to wrap our minds around, so we can think of a couple analogies. One is if we were lying on our back looking up into a perfect blue sky, and every so often a cloud comes in at one side, passes across our field of vision, and goes out the other side. The cloud is not the sky. The cloud is in the sky, but it is not the sky. In the same way, our thoughts are in our mind, but they are not the mind itself. Or we can think that we're looking up at a perfectly clear night sky, and we see the stars in the sky. Those are the thoughts in our mind, the empty space in between the stars. That's our mind. So working with those analogies, getting a sense of what we're talking about, let's just look at the minds that come, the thoughts that come up in our mind. A sound. Another sound. A sound farther off. A memory. A muscle ache. Each one just a temporary little blip that arises in the mind, exists for a moment, and then fades away. The mind is the empty space in which the thoughts arise and exist and fade away. So just notice the thoughts, let them go, and be aware of the empty space in which they occur. And we can end our meditation by doing a brief dedication. We may have found it very confusing. That's okay. Still give yourself a pat on the back. And may that positive imprint that you've created, however small it is, ripen in the future in a way to benefit all sentient beings. Okay, that's it for tonight. Thank you, everyone. And the homework is outside the doors. And we'll continue next week, class number 3. Any announcements, Linda?
No, you said homework is just outside the door on the table there.
Okay, great. Thank you.